The Museum of Modern Art in New York is currently running a retrospective of the films directed by Vincent Minnelli. My guest Stephen Harvey is the museum's associate curator of film. He's also the author of the new book, Directed by Vincent Minnelli. Minnelli was one of the most stylish directors of his day. Between the years 1943 and 1976, he made 34 films, among them the musicals Cabin in the Sky, Meet Me in St. Louis, An American in Paris, The Bandwagon, Brigadoon, Gigi, and Bells Are Ringing. His melodramas include The Clock, The Bad and the Beautiful, Lust for Life, Some Came Running, and The Sandpiper. And he also directed the comedies Father of the Bride, Designing Woman, and The Courtship of Eddie's Father. In the 1950s, Minnelli married one of his leading ladies, Judy Garland. Liza Minnelli is their daughter. Minnelli was under contract to MGM for 26 years and made all but three of his films there. I asked Stephen Harvey if Minnelli helped define the now classic style of the MGM musical.
Yes, he certainly did, because first of all, he came along to MGM in the early 40s at a time when the great producer of musicals, Arthur Freed, was really hitting his stride. And so their collaboration is really largely what we think of when we think of the MGM musical. Also, it was a sort of quirk of timing in that Technicolor was really only coming in for the first time in general use in the studios by the early 40s. And he was somebody who really thought in terms of color, because as a set designer on Broadway in the 30s, he'd really sort of reshaped the way the Broadway Revue looked in terms of bold use of color and so on, and he was able to adapt that talent to the screen. And so a film like Meet Me in St. Louis, which was his first color film, his third film, really sort of not revolutionized quite, but certainly changed the way color was used. It was used, you know, to really express emotion, to express a particular period of, as the film was set in turn of the century, Midwestern America, and he wanted to really use the colors that would have been used in a Victorian house of that period. And so, from then on, really, the MGM musical's fortunes were linked largely to Minnelli and to Arthur Freed.
What sets apart his musical production numbers from other production numbers of the period?
Well, one of them is, again, the enormous attention he paid to decor. He was notorious, Minnelli, when shooting films, to sort of hold up shooting for days at a time while he rearranged the look of the film. And as someone who had started as an art director, the decors, the colors, were much more important to him than directors like, for example, contemporaries of his like George Sidney or Charles Walters. The other thing was his use of the mobile camera, because the use of boom shots, tracking shots, to sort of underscore the rhythms of the music and the dancing was something that he really developed in a much more sophisticated way than any other director before or since. So there's an extraordinary sense of mobility in his production numbers. You look at the American Paris Ballet, for example, or the Dream Ballet in Yolanda and the Thief, or the Dream Ballet in The Pirate. And they're very mobile and very cinematic, in which the main character, the dancer or the singer, is just one object in his direction, and part of this sort of organic scene, not just the focal point, but part of his decor.
My guest is Stephen Harvey, and he's the associate curator in the Department of Film at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and they're running a retrospective of Vincent Minnelli's films. And Harvey's just written a book called Directed by Vincent Minnelli. One of Vincent Minnelli's movies that's always very popular this time of year is Meet Me in St. Louis,
yes,
which stars Judy Garland, and it's become something of a Christmas movie because the climax happens at Christmas time,
yes,
and she sings Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Indeed, yes.
This was one of the few movie musicals of its time, one of the first, really, to have the songs integrated into the story. Why was it so unusual then?
Well, actually, the making of Meet Me in St. Louis was engendered by two stage phenomena, basically. One was the success of Oklahoma, which again is considered, not entirely accurately, but to a certain extent it's true, as the first really integrated Broadway musical. And again, a musical set in the American past, in which the songs are sort of interwoven as closely as possible with the plot. And the second popular stage phenomenon was Life with Father, again, a nostalgic domestic tale of an American family, more or less at the turn of the century. And the success of these two plays on Broadway sort of influenced MGM into thinking that they could make something of this sort. You know, the irony is that in some ways Meet Me in St. Louis proved even more enduring, certainly, than Life with Father.
You also say it was very unusual to show a typical American family in a musical. Yeah,
exactly.
Were most musicals more show busy,
exactly,
about people on the stage and screen?
Precisely. The musicals, 9 times out of 10, musicals were about, well, Mickey and Judy putting on a show, whether on Broadway or in their backyard or whatever. It was considered sort of too difficult before Meet Me in St. Louis, really, to do a musical in which, without a backstage story, because it would be too implausible to have these interludes of music interrupting a story. And Meet Me in St. Louis was one of the first, you know, to do this really successfully without a show business context.
Vincent Minnelli had to convince Judy Garland to star,
yes,
in this movie. Why was she so reluctant?
Well, by that point, Judy Garland was about 22, 23 years old, and she was still playing 17-year-olds. And in fact, in Meet Me in St. Louis, Esther Smith is 17 and at one point cries, "I've waited all my life to be a senior." And so Garland was really tired of playing that sort of part. And so she just, for that reason alone, she decided that Meet Me in St. Louis was not what the kind of thing she wanted to do. She wanted to play grown-ups. And so at one point before production started, she called Minnelli, whom she really, really scarcely knew at that point, into her dressing room at the studio and said, "Well, it's really not very good, is it, the script that we've been handed?" And Minnelli said, "Oh, no, you're quite wrong. It's very good indeed." And when she expressed her dismay, he basically convinced her that together they could make something special out of it, which they did. And in fact, this was the making of Meet Me in St. Louis. It was the start of their romance. A year after the film was completed, they were married.
Well, this was a period when Judy Garland was having a lot of troubles with barbiturates and other drugs, a lot of problems with anxiety and insecurity. And here she was being directed by her lover and then husband. What was it like for him to direct her during that period?
Well, actually, the real problem started later. Even the problems with barbiturates, as I understand it, really didn't completely develop until a couple of years later. Meet Me in St. Louis was a relatively tranquil shoot for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequently, the next year, they made The Clock together, which was apparently a very, very happy shoot. And during a period when she was, in fact, trying, you know, not to depend so much on barbiturates and so forth. The real problems occurred later on, even between them, with the making of the musical The Pirate, which was shot in 1947, after they'd been married, after the birth of their daughter Liza. One of the problems there was that, you know, Minnelli really was in effect a kind of Svengali to her Trilby, in that he was, with the series of films they made together, he was trying to sort of make a more mature artist out of Garland. I think on a certain level, she welcomed that very much, welcomed that attempt, but also perhaps resented it. During the making of The Pirate, their personal relationship and professional relationship really did clash quite a bit, and it was a very long shoot, 6 months, partly because of Garland's difficulties. And their marriage after The Pirate was never quite the same either, and they separated a couple of years later, then divorced in the early 50s.
Well, in fact, when she was signed to do the musical Easter Parade, Vincent Minnelli was supposed to direct her, but her psychiatrist, you say, suggested that he not do the movie.
Precisely,
yeah.
And it, in a way, it shows Minnelli's, you know, sort of total dedication to work, which, you know, extended to a kind of tunnel vision, that it had never occurred to him after the problems on The Pirate that Easter Parade would not be a good idea as another collaboration. I think probably her psychiatrist was quite correct.
One of Minnelli's best-known musicals is An American in Paris, which starred Gene Kelly. An American in Paris ends with the now famous, I think it's 17-minute ballet sequence, to Gershwin's composition, An American in Paris. What was Vincent Minnelli's approach to staging it? And I should say here that the choreography was done by Gene Kelly.
Yes. Well, you know, again, basically the idea was to incorporate, you know, ideas from Impressionist paintings into choreography and dance and emotion. And Kelly's responsibility was the choreography, and while Minnelli's was the sort of overriding concept. And again, you really see there what I was talking about earlier in the sense of his camera mobility sort of adding to the emotion of the music and of the dance. And also, you know, he had always been someone influenced very much by painters. He had studied painting at the Art Institute of Chicago when he was young. And when he was a set designer in the theater, many of his sets, sort of incorporated ideas from the painters of that era, people like Magritte and Dali and so forth. And so basically here he was doing the same thing 15 years later, you know, with the Impressionist painters. And that was his, you know, his great contribution. The sense of color, the use of color is really extraordinary in the movie and in the ballet, rather. And the seamlessness with which it goes from one movement to another through this, you know, sort of moving camera of Minnelli, it's really quite astonishing still, I think.
The Bandwagon, a musical directed by Vincent Minnelli, starring Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse, was made in 1953. And to my mind, in a way, this was one of, like, the last of the great musicals.
Yes.
I wonder if you feel that way, too.
Well, I do agree, actually. It's certainly, except for Gigi, it's his penultimate great musical, Minnelli's. One of the things I love about The Bandwagon is that, apart from the extraordinary variety of musical numbers, is that it sort of exemplifies certain themes of Minnelli movies. Many of his movies, not just the musicals, but the melodramas as well. One of the themes that comes up over and over again in Minnelli's work is the necessity for work. That work is the thing that motivates you and that gives you fulfillment in life. And also underneath the sort of sophisticated, even gaudy surfaces of these musicals, what makes Minnelli's musicals distinctive is that there's almost always an undertone of melancholy in them, and that's also certainly true in The Bandwagon, which is the story of a sort of has-been Hollywood star who is beginning to lose his self-confidence in his own powers and then gradually regains them through adapting his talents to a Broadway play with a whole new group of collaborators. And there's a lot of melancholy in the movie, specifically at the beginning, towards the beginning, Fred Astaire's wonderful solo to By Myself, the Dancing in the Dark duet between him and Charisse. And this is a quality that Minnelli brought, you know, really just about all of his musicals, and that I find very interesting.
The duet that Astaire and Sid Charisse dance to Dancing in the Dark takes place in Central Park, but it's really a soundstage.
It certainly is. They never go outside in that movie. It's all done at the studio at MGM. It's not even done on the outdoor back lot. All of it is done in soundstages.
Now, I think a lot of movie makers today are paying homage to Minnelli in a way by getting an almost hallucinogenic soundstage look, you know,
yes.
an almost super realist look by going with the soundstage instead of going out into reality.
No.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, it's true. It's a tendency that started among a number of filmmakers in the 70s, people like Scorsese and Coppola.
Yeah.
And, you know, these were people who really grew up on these movies and reveled in their artificiality, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny because at one point I remember we were showing some Minnelli excerpts for a program at the museum several years ago, and Scorsese was there, and so was Liza Minnelli. And one of the sequences we showed was from The Bad and the Beautiful, in which Lana Turner has a nervous breakdown in her car, and it was all done on a turntable. It's very artificial and very dramatic and exciting. And Liza Minnelli was standing there, and she realized that it was basically the same scene as she had filmed in New York for Scorsese, where she has a fight in a car with Robert De Niro when she's on the verge of giving birth, actually, in the film. And so she turned to Scorsese and said, you know, boss, I didn't know you took that from Daddy's movie. And Scorsese totally deadpan said, of course I did, you know. And this is something, and also Coppola with movies like One from the Heart certainly have imitated that sort of deliberately artificial style. And also a lot of music video. A lot of music mm-hmm. video has, you know, sort of gone back to Minnelli production numbers and you know, you sort of use them as inspiration.
Did Minnelli have a choice? Could he, for instance, have shot that Dancing in the Dark number in Central Park or did he have to do it on the soundstage?
Well, in that period, in the late 40s and the early 50s, it was very unusual to go on location and very expensive and very complicated. In fact, there had been some talk of making an American in Paris, rather, in Paris. There had been some talk of that, and up to about a month before shooting started, they were considering it very seriously. But then as one of the art directors on the film, Preston Ames, said to Kelly, you know, have you ever danced on cobblestones? And that was one of the things that sort of scotched that, was that it was considered sort of too complicated to shoot musical numbers, you know, in real locations. But in the early 50s, it really wasn't possible. And Brigadoon was another film where there was some talk of shooting it in Scotland, but because of weather conditions, they decided, in fact, that it had to be done on a soundstage. And there were times when Minnelli welcomed that, because, again, for the American in Paris Ballet, there was really no need to go to Paris because it was about Impressionist art, not really about Paris per se. And it was really easier, indeed, to recreate those on big cycloramas, those canvases on big cycloramas at the studio. Something like Brigadoon, he would much have preferred to shoot on location. And actually, from the mid-50s on, more location work was done, not so much for musicals, but Gigi is one example of a film that was shot largely in Paris instead of on the soundstage. And of course, the look is very, very different as a result.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Harvey is my guest. He's the associate curator in the film department at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where they're now running a retrospective of Vincent Minnelli's films. And Stephen Harvey has also written a new book called Directed by Vincent Minnelli. Why do you think in the 1950s the classic Hollywood musical kind of starts its downward slide?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One is that, in fact, music was changing. Popular music was changing with the advent of rock and roll in the mid-50s. And also, you know, I think the great stars of the movie musical, the classic movie musical, were getting older. I mean, Astaire by this point was in his mid-50s. Even Gene Kelly was in his late 40s by the mid to late 50s. Judy Garland was in decline, at least in terms of her acting career. And so, you know, the performers were waning somewhat. And again, the musical style was changing. Also, it was becoming more and more expensive to make these films by the mid to late 50s. And with all movie audiences dwindling because of television, and the movie musical especially, because young people really preferred rock and roll, there was sort of less of a demand for them. So that was really, I think, the reason. And by the late 50s, most of the movie musicals that were being done were either adaptations of sort of pre-sold Broadway hits or something like Gigi, which was the closest thing to it because it was conceived and written by Lerner and Lowe, who had done My Fair Lady, and in effect it was My Fair Lady with a French accent.
Did Vincent Minnelli ever have the sense that he was working past his time?
Well, I think that was true perhaps in the 60s, not in the late 50s with the musical so much, but by the 60s, the whole studio system, which had nurtured him, really was falling apart by then, and it was very hard for him to conceive of a professional life without that army of technicians that he had relied on to sort of realize the look that he wanted on film. So I certainly think by the mid-60s, he was aware that the kind of movies he made, the kind of relationship he had with the studio really were anachronisms.
We've been talking about Vincent Minnelli's musicals. He also made quite a few melodramas, including The Bad and the Beautiful, Some Came Running, Lust for Life. How much control did he have as an under-contract studio director at MGM? How much control did he have over the choice of which movies he got to direct?
Well, there were certainly movies that he turned down, things that the studio wanted him to do, which he didn't do. He never was on suspension for disobeying them. And once in a while, he was forced to do something he really didn't want to do, like the film version of Kismet, which was a musical comedy he really didn't like. And he was sort of blackmailed into doing it by saying, if you want to do Lust for Life, which was a project he really wanted to do desperately, first he had to shoot Kismet. But especially once the film started shooting, he had a great deal of autonomy on the set because MGM really trusted him. And so he was really given an awful lot of latitude in terms of the way he shot his films.
The Museum of Modern Art is running a retrospective of Minnelli's films. I'm sure you ran your own retrospective while writing your book.
Oh, yes, I certainly did.
Yeah, watching all of his movies over and over again. So what did you see in his films that you hadn't noticed before? What surprised you?
Well, again, one of the things was that while the musicals and the melodramas, you know, seemed so different in terms of subject matter, Minnelli's style sort of linked them together into a sort of coherent whole in the sense that, again, as I mentioned earlier, the musicals had an unexpected melancholy, and that became clearer and clearer to me as I watched them again. And the melodramas had the kind of visual vitality and the spirit that the musicals did. I mean, one thing one notices after a while with the melodramas, films like Home from the Hill and Some Came Running and Lust for Life and Madame Bovary, his version of the Flaubert novel, is that a lot of them build up to a set piece, which is like a movie musical production number, in which, you know, the camera goes crazy and the decor glistens and the main character has a kind of a personal epiphany. So in Madame Bovary, there's this extraordinary ball sequence, which is taken from the book, in which Emma Bovary, you know, sort of realizes for the first time that she has aspirations beyond her station, and the camera does these 360-degree whirls, and the dancers go crazy, and windows are shattered, and it's, again, like a musical production number, but it's one of the melodramas, and it works within that context very well. There's a ballet in Brigadoon, in which one of the characters tries to escape Brigadoon and is chased through the heather and through the fields and forests, and which is very much like a sequence in one of his more stark melodramas, Home from the Hill, which is a boar hunt through the wilds of East Texas. So, and yet the style in which they're shot is really very similar.
Some movie musicals are about the conflict between pop and the fine arts. I mean, even The Bandwagon, you know, Esther is a kind of hoofer, a man of the musical, and Cicherice is a ballet dancer, very refined, and they think that they'll never be able to get along with each other. And in a way, you could say that that's the relationship that movies and museums have had until recently. Mm. Movies have been mass entertainment, popular culture, and museums kind of reserved for the fine arts. And now, you know, like in the Museum of Modern Art, there's a film department, there's film screenings. What do you see as the role of the museum in dealing with film?
Well, I think there are basically two roles. I mean, one of them is indeed to keep the history of film alive and to keep it alive on film, by which I mean, you know, over the last 10 years with the video cassette revolution, you know, one can see old films in a way much more easily than one could have before. But to see them on a small screen is really not the way they were intended. And so, you know, some place like the museum is one of the last places left where you can see a 35-millimeter print projected on a big screen of old films. But also we have a second function, I think, which is to alert our public to new trends in movies and in film with programs like our New Directors, New Films series, which we do every spring, which shows the work of unknown, new directors. And so I think, you know, basically those are our two great functions. And I mean, among the other series that over the last few years that I've organized personally are sort of unknown films from, or lesser known films from Italy and France and so forth. We did a series on Anna Magnani, the great Italian actress, last year, which showed films of hers that had never been seen in this country before in some cases, or if they had, not in 30 years. And it's, you know, by major directors like Pasolini and Rossellini and so forth. So, you know, that's certainly one of the things that I try to do with the programs that I organize.
Well, Stephen Harvey, thanks for talking with us about the work of Vincent Minnelli. Thank you for your time.
It was a great pleasure.